we were talking about Ken Rinpoche's life and how he, lived the Lam Rim, right? And we were halfway through, we were partway through his practice of the first perfection of giving, and that he gave the Dharma, you know, highest practice of giving. And then I thought it was good to talk about what he taught in each of the great subjects. And then there was an underlying teaching going on. You know, there was a technical teaching, passing on of data, information. And then there was deeper levels of teaching going on. So there's two more subjects that he taught. We finished the five great books. And he taught also Lam Rim. And in the monastery, you don't study Lam Rim. You study the five great books, and that's where the Lam Rim comes from. But sometimes great lamas come, like His Holiness will come, or Chichen Rinpoche used to come, and his teacher, and they would teach the Lam Rim. And then it's sort of like a holiday, or it's like a break. So you don't have classes for 2 weeks, and they'll go through a whole Lam Rim. But Rinpoche felt that it was very important for Westerners to learn Lam Rim also. So he taught a lot of different Lam Rims. He taught... Ayanagarjuna wrote a book called Surleka Shitting, The Letter to a Friend, which is a letter from Nagarjuna to a king advising him about how to live his life and how to rule his kingdom. And this is basically, if you study it, it's like a very ancient type of Lam Rim. So he taught that, and then it was he and Art Engel translated it together. And I came after that, but I got to work on editing it for 2 or 3 years. And that was the first one that I was exposed to. Then he taught Lam Rim Ser Shunma, which means Essence of Refined Gold. And this is by a Mongolian Lama. And this is a short Lam Rim, and it was a very good introduction to Lam Rim, a very basic one. And we translated that, and he donated the book to the Library of Tibetan Dharamsala. He taught Lam Rim Dudun and a text called Lam Rim Ding, parts of Lam Rim Chemo. These are three varying lengths of Lam Rim by Jetsun Kapa. And then Jetsun Kapa's Nyamgur, which is like his song of my spiritual life or something like that. And so he taught all those Lam Rims, but the main Lam Rim that he was interested in was, a gift of liberation in the palm of your hands, and by Pabongkor Rinpoche, who had been his teacher in Lhasa. That Lam Rim was so powerful. It was given in 1921, I believe. It was so powerful. It was a series of lectures, and it was so powerful that it was an immediate hit. People carved it right away. It was edited. His disciple, Trijang Rinpoche, edited it. He did an unbelievable job. It's perfect. I mean, it's just the perfect work. I think it's the great... People ask me, what's the greatest book in Tibet? I think it's the greatest book ever written, maybe. But it's just an amazing, beautiful, perfect Lam Rim. And Trijang Rinpoche was a consummate writer, poet. Composition, grammar was perfect. So he worked on it for years. His teacher's lectures. It's a lecture. It's lecture notes. It's just extraordinary. And then, so Ken Rinpoche taught that. He taught the whole thing twice in New Jersey, and he taught it once in Washington. It took about 10 years each round. And I was fortunate enough, because I was his driver, so I got to hear both of them. And it was just unbelievable, you know. And what I learned from that was he was teaching that Lam Rim from having heard it from that Lama. You see, he was there. He was there, not when that one was taught, but the next... Pabongkor Rinpoche did another round of the same Lam Rim later at Sera, and Rinpoche was there. And so he heard the whole cycle from Pabongkor Rinpoche. And you just got this And whenever he taught that Lamrim, it wasn't a book anymore. It was this blessing being carried on from century to century by living people. They call Shashe, you know, heard from the mouth of your teacher, right? And it was this beautiful experience. Like, he wouldn't look at the book much. He'd just look and see what subject it was, and then he would, you know, he knew what the book said because his teachers had written it, right? And he had this, you had this sense that you were in the room with Pabongka Rinpoche giving the teaching, you know. So I think what I realized from the Lamrim was the power of the oral tradition, you know, the power of the Lama's blessing, and how books are, books in Tibet are almost like a vehicle. They're just an excuse for the Lama to pass on. They're an outline. And they might look at it and they might not look at it, but but it's an excuse to pour into you the blessing that's been poured into them. And it's just a vehicle. It's just like pancakes are for butter. That's why we're late, and I'm sorry. We were kidnapped by Earl Bernie's pancake makers in Brie. And, you know, forced to eat pile of pancake for the youth center. And thank you for doing that. It's very beautiful. It looked really fun. Looked good. So that was Lamrim, and that was the thing. It just felt like you were with Pabongka Rinpoche. And getting this blessing. And he didn't think it was weird to go through it three times over a 25-year period, you know? And it was just part of our life that every Sunday we would get this, you know? Then the last subject he taught us was Tantra, secret teachings. And he didn't do it easily. He was very slow in doing it. First he taught us Jorcha. Jorcha is like the preliminary practices, like cleaning your room, etc. But he took a long time to teach that. That was the first thing he taught as a preparation for Tantra. So that took, I think, 2 years. And then he gave us initiations, and we didn't know what was going on. Like, he took us into this room, and he gave us initiation. And I told you, like, we went... There were some students there from other states. We had rented a YMCA camp for them to stay in. And it was like 45 minutes away under the Jersey State... What's it called? Parkway? The Parkway. The Garden State Parkway, yeah. It was like under and over, you know, it was really weird. And with a lake and forest and everything. And we went out there and we all sat around and said, what happened? What did he do? You know, and... I remember that the dawn came up over the lake, and we were still sitting there trying to figure out what the heck did, what happened, what did he say, you know? And all night we were just like trying to figure out what happened, you know? What did he teach us, you know? And then I thought to go on to the other perfections, and then I actually thought we'll try to finish Rinpoche's Lamrim life by the end of this course. And then people are going to work on, I think, Betts and Alistair. Jim Day's been helping, and Chinzom. But we're going to make a little book, I think, out of the Delam and Rinpoche stuff, and then the poetry of the first Panchen Lama. So they're going to, like, make it into a coherent... maybe throughout 60%, 70%. Okay, that simplicity is better. But I'll have to talk for 2 hours. So anyway, the next thing I was thinking about his practice of ethics, right, morality, which is the next perfection. And I have stories. These are funny stories. I don't remember what stories I told him, what I didn't. So you just be polite and listen, okay? So as far as morality, I was thinking about stealing and sexual misconduct. Stealing, we had this thing where we didn't have much support, financial support. I mean, The temple in New Jersey is a lot like any typical like small Christian church somewhere in a neighborhood where the young people are not staying there anymore. It's an ethnic neighborhood. It's a Mongolian neighborhood. And then the kids get 16 and they move away now. They don't hang around. So then the population's getting older and older. I mean, the average age when I was there was 80 or something, you know, of the congregation. And when I first got there, they had a custom of, which came from Mongolia, where one family would feed the monks each one day of the month. So somebody would say, I'm taking the 12th of the month. So every 12th of the month, they would come with a big meal and feed the monks. Like Vietnamese do this and Burmese do this. And it was a good custom. You know, like maybe most of the month was covered. Then, you know, by the time I'd been there 10, 15 years, they were all dead. And we only got 2 meals a month or something like that, you know. And there was no support for the monks, for the Sangha. But people would come into the temple and leave money on the altar, right? So that's a custom. And so people would leave a dime or 5 cents or, you know, like this. And then Rinpoche would, this is his level of integrity, right? He would carefully, like, every penny, he would put it in this big box, this big wooden box in the temple, you know? And he would lock it very carefully and he would keep it all very carefully. And then it would fill up mostly pennies, okay? A few dollar bills, you know? So then, I don't know, but I started working at $7 an hour or something. By the end, I was making $300 an hour or something like that. And so at the end, like, he's still bringing out this box of pennies, right? And he'd bring it into the kitchen. And he'd say, okay, we got to count it, you know? And I'm like, Rinpoche, it's going to take me 2-3 hours to count that. He said, yeah, I know. I could make $1,000 for you in the meantime. You know, just let me go to New York for the day. And he's like, no, no. This is dollar money. We have to count it, this has to be counted properly, you know. So he dumped this box out on the kitchen table. And I don't know if you ever, it's this huge pile of pennies, you know. And then you just sit there all day counting pennies and putting them into these rolls, you know. And then at the end of the day, you got this huge stack of rolls. It's like $16, you know. And no, it's like that. And then Tibetans believe that the patina on coins is poisonous. They think it's toxic to touch money, even bills. Or they believe there's something toxic about it. So we had to go through this big detox thing and you know, we had to wash our hands and do a ritual and get... I don't know if it's the karma of many people touching it. I don't know what it is. But it's something, you know, it was very dangerous and then you had to go wash yourself properly and then we had to fill out in triplicate the $16.38, and then we had to call the. I had to walk to the temple treasurer with this big jola full of pennies, and present it to him. And then he had to sign, and then the president had to sign, and then like that was Rinpoche's thing, and he didn't have any money, right? He's taking care of this whole place, and he never took a penny. You see, I mean, he never took a single penny from the temple, you see. So that's like his level of integrity. Bodhisattva Bhava, I was thinking about, oh, sexual misconduct, there's a story. We had driven to Drepung for the winter debates or something, and he got that wry neck thing. He fell asleep in the car. It's a 12-hour, it's a very frightening drive. You see lots of people die on the road. Indian roads are like crazy. There's no lines. It's only wide enough for a car and a half. These huge buses come and run head ahead, you know, and you see like 50 people die. And, you know, all kinds of animals are on the road, cows, chickens, pigs. People are going 60 miles an hour down the road, you know, and it's just, he's just asleep through the whole thing. And, but he got this neck problem, and then we were trying to fix it, and, one of my students from New York, I don't know, Janet Diamond, you know? She was like this professional masseuse, like worked at the Sheraton Hotel or something like that. So she offered to come down and work on his neck, you know? So it was on a Sunday before class, And she said, I'll come like 15 minutes early. We'll do Rinpoche's neck, you know. So she came with this table, this collapsible table. And she set it all up in his room. And he said, he told me, you have to stay here. You know, she can't work on me without a monk present, you know. And so, like, she said, well, you have to take your top off. And so he lays down on the table. And then she starts to work on him. I've never seen him out of his robes. You know, once when he went to the shore to go swimming, right, he wore a swimsuit. At the car, he changed, you know. But I've never seen him out of his robe, you see. And so she's, like, working on him, and she's, like, doing all this stuff, and, you know, with her, you know, like this. And then he falls asleep, you know. He's, like, blissed out, you know. And it was very funny. And then the students come up and knock on the door, you know, it's time to start class. And I said, give us 5 more minutes, you know. And I don't want to wake him up. I don't know what to do, you know. And he's just conked out, you know. And me and Janet are standing there, you know. And he slept for like 45 minutes. And we're afraid to wake him up, you know. And finally, he like woke up, you know. And he says, what happened, you know. I said, oh, you've been asleep. You know, how long? I don't know, 45 minutes, an hour maybe or something. He said, what's going on in the class? They're waiting for you, you know. And I said, how's your neck feeling? You know, he says, it's cured, you know. It's cured, you know. And he says, I feel 10 years younger. You know, I'm like, wow. And she says, so Rinpoche, I'll come every week and I'll do it for you. He says, that's enough. That's it. You know, and he never did it again. It was really weird. It's like, you know, that's proper and that's enough. And that's like the sexiest day I had. He's just pure, totally pure. You know, and I was like, you know, he took his robes at 7 years old. And I never saw the least bit of any impurity that way. Nothing. You know, when you're around somebody 24/7, you should see something, right? But nothing. Okay? So pure. Then I was thinking about Bodhisattvas. Dr. Shenmue Chuno Miteshin. And there was a vow about how wrong it is for a Bodhisattva to refuse other people money and dharma, right? Material help and spiritual help. And so whereas the Pratimoksha vows are mostly, don't do this, you know, don't commit sexual misconduct, don't steal the temple's money, right? Bodhisattva vows are more like, you have to help the temple. You have to do something for the temple. It's not so much negative as positive, right? So I was reflecting, you know, as we were building this temple, right? He went to such great lengths to make a mandala for his students, you know, financial and spiritual. You see, I mean, so that Bodhisattva vow, which to me typifies how he kept his Bodhisattva vows, he just worked so hard to make that place a mandala for people to come to, right? And it was open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the temple, right? And he raised all the money for the temple. You know, he personally took responsibility. He built everything there, you know? Like, the temple was there. There was a huge pile of garbage outside, construction garbage when we got there. There were no trees, no grass, no garage, no fence, no driveway, nothing. It was a wasteland. And it just had big piles of toxic waste and junk, piles of construction debris there. So he, like, went out himself. He, like, cleaned it up. It took us, like, 3-4 years to clean it up. You know, we went on load by load in the car, in the Volkswagen. We took loads of crap to the junkyard, you know. And he just did it, you know. He was out there for 3 years trying to get a tree stumped out of the ground behind the house by hand. And he did, you know. And he just, it took like 3 years. And he just, every day he went out and he worked. When he was 75, I come home one night, he's out pouring cement on the, he's like mixed the cement himself, and then he's out pouring cement on the sidewalk. So I just thought I'd redo this piece of the sidewalk, you know. I'm saying, Rinpoche, you're 75 years old, you know. You know, and he's like got this shovel, and he's like, he's mixing the cement. I found out, oh, I found some clay out back. Look, you know, and he takes me out back. He's got this pit going, and he found this clay, and he mixes it with the cement. It's really good for the fire puja, you know. And, no, he's like that. And he was painting until he was 80. He was painting the temple and stuff like that. So he just took responsibility to make physically not that many students helped, you see. He just decided it was his duty to make sure that he took care that there was a beautiful place for people to study. And, you know, it is a beautiful place, right? It's a very, you walk on the grounds and there's gardens and flowers and the temple's spotless and he would clean it constantly, be up on ladders cleaning things, and he got this whole thing rigged up to clean the steeple. You know, it's like four bamboo poles tied together and he's cleaning the steeple from the inside and like that, you know. And then dharma-wise, he just took care of us, you know, everything. So for that vow, you know, he's not only not withholding anything, he's like taking responsibility. He would come down at 11 o'clock at night, midnight, and clean all the toilets, you know, constantly. People just leave him dirty. So he'd be down there at midnight. And I'd be embarrassed, but I didn't feel like I could come out, you know. In my room, I'd hear him cleaning them, you know. And that's Bodhisattva vows. Tantric vows, I was trying to think of something special, right? Lama Nyima Lacha Kisaje. The first tantric vow of all is to have a proper view of your Lama. And I don't have much new to say about that, you know. His whole life, the reason he came to America, the reason he stayed here, and what he spent his whole day doing was only what his lamas had asked him to do, right? Dalai Lama and Chijang Rinpoche. So he never did anything else, so it was transparent. You didn't notice it, right? But for the 30-something years that I knew him, he didn't ever do anything other than that. You see what I mean? He didn't do anything else. It didn't even occur to him to do anything else, you see? So teaching us, translating the Lamrim, you know, passing on what he knew under His Holiness's orders, right? That's all he wanted to do. He didn't. So I don't have much to say. He just did it his whole life, every day. It took his whole life. And he never thought of doing anything else, you see? So that's tantric practice, right? Morality. Tantric morality. So that's his morality. I'll do one more. Let's see. Patience, right? I thought of a story about patience. This was my introduction to Rinpoche's patience. He's patient with me, but I'm not counting that. I think it's around 1975, and this guy calls us, and he says, I've attended some of Rinpoche's teachings, and I'm trying to get a doctorate, a PhD. Rinpoche used to make fun of people like this. He said, oh, this is another PhD guy. He wants to come here and do a thesis, you know. He wants me to be the informant, the native informant for his thesis, you know. He hated that, you know. So, but the guy says, can I come and, you know, work on my thesis with you? He's like, yeah, okay, come, you know. And he arranged him a special place to stay out back in one of the houses, you know. And he was very sincere and he was very intelligent. And so he came and he worked. He was going to do Lamrim applications to American education. And he stayed for a couple weeks, 3-4 weeks. And then he was trying to do special meditations like Bardo meditations or death, you know, and certain practices. Remember she said, don't do that. Channel practices without training. He read some book like the Tibetan Book of Death. People read books, you know. They're like, oh, I'm going to do this. Rinpoche, don't do that. You know, and he says, yeah, no, I want to do it. You know, and, no, you can't do that. You know, and then, of course, he went and did it, you know. And then he started to go cuckoo, you know. And he was having problems with his wife, you know, like some kind of problems with his wife. So he was already like something wrong, angry or upset when he got there. And then this just made everything worse. So you could see he was just boiling, you know. And then he got sick. And he started to get, you know, Rinpoche tried to take care of him. And he said, you know, what's wrong with him? He didn't have any energy. He's like sick. Oh, momos will take care of him. Momos, you know. So we made momos, you know, chop a hamburger by hand. Chop a piece of sirloin steak into a hamburger, put in lots of butter for him because he's got lung, you know, and then special spices, and then erma is red pepper or something like that, you know. It helps with the heart, calm down the heart. So we made momo, you know, we were just down there making this guy momos for 3 hours a day and feeding him special and making him happy, and then he just got worse and worse. He started to get stomach problems. So I think Nancy, you know Empty Lama? Empty Lama, right? Empty Lama was, he's this old Mongolian. You see, in the old days, the doctors in Mongolia were the monks. And most monks had medical training. And then there's this word in Tibetan called Emchi. And the word spread to Mongolia, Emchi. And actually, Rashi Gyalpo Ling was founded by a monk doctor named Shar Emchi. And Shar means yellow, meaning golden robe. And Emchi means doctor. So he led the comics out of World War II trenches of the Nazis. He got them out. He got them to Berlin by the end of the war. You know, they had like 5 wagons of Buddha images and paintings. They wanted to bring furniture. He fought with them. He made them throw the furniture away. All the paintings in that temple were brought on wagons, by horse wagon, out of Kalmykia, across the Nazi lines, you know. And because of Sharamji, he's just this guy. He's this little guy, you know. And then he passed, but Empty Lama was at another temple. And he was this old Mongolian, and he was a very skilled physician, traditional physician. And people would go to him all the time. So Rinpoche says, take this guy to Empty Lama. He's, you know, he needs a doctor. So I took him there, and he gave him, he studied him, he gave him all this medicine, you know. So we came home, and like we're spending all day trying to take care of this guy, and then he just flips out and he just leaves, you know. When he just leaves. And then like, 3 weeks later we get this letter from the Indiana State Police or something that says so-and-so has filed criminal charges against Ken Rinpoche for poisoning him. You know, and can you respond to these? You know, this is just a letter of information. The charges are being filed. You know, Rinpoche, we got to get going on this. You know, this is a big thing in America. You know, you can go to jail, you can get sued, things can happen. You can lose a temple, things can happen, you know. And he's like, what do you mean, you know? And he says, no, he's filed a complaint. He's like, he's charged you with some crime, you know. And you have to defend yourself. We have to go to Sharamji. We have to get the medicine. We have to get it, you know, an analysis done in a laboratory. We have to get witnesses, depositions. We got to prepare. We got to get a lawyer, you know. He's like, wait, he's my student, you know. And I said, remember, James, he's going to, you know, it's going to be bad. And he's like, no, he's my student. I can't hurt him, you know. You know, he can hurt me. He could do something to me, but I can't hurt my student, you know. So just cool it, you know, just let it happen. I'm like, Rinpoche, something's going to happen here. He's like, no, I can't hurt my student, you know. So, we just waited, basically. Then a year went by, and nothing came, you know. And then we get this package, this big package, you know, from this guy. I see his name on it. I'm like, oh, my God, this is it, you know. And I open it up, and it's his doctoral thesis, you know. And he says, Rinpoche, could you critique it for me and, you know, approve it for my board? What do you call it, the examiner?
Advisors.
My advisors, yeah. They need your signature on it, you know. I'm like, Rinpoche. He's like, what's wrong? And he said, I think you should just burn it or throw it out or something, you know. And he's like, no, he's my student. He's my student, you know. And there's two kinds of anger, right, in Tibet. They call Toa and Kunzin. Toa means the day that they attack you. Do you get angry or not? You see, the day that the attack comes, do you respond? In the immediate attack, do you get angry? Kunzin means, do you hold it? for a month or a year or 5 years. You see, it's called, I don't know what you call it, Ben.
Retaining.
It's like, do you retain this anger? Yeah, like a grudge, but worse than a grudge, like something powerful. Do you hold this burning thing inside of you for the rest of your life, maybe, you know? And he just didn't have either one. You see, in the fire of the moment, he's like, he's my student. I can't do anything. And then a year later, he's like, that's good, he's got his thesis together, you know? Let's sign off on it, you know? Let's read it together, you know? So he reads it, and he signs off, and the guy got his doctorate, and he never came back. And it was such, you know, and then I said, you know, this is patience. You know, this is real patience, you know? He didn't have any anger, and it was really beautiful. So it's a good lesson, especially those of you who are teaching, most of you are teaching. Stuff like that happens, stuff like that will come. It's powerful, powerful obstacles when you teach somebody. Stuff like that will happen. Don't, you know, you've heard it, you know, it happened to Rinpoche lots of times. If it can happen with him, it will happen with us, you know. So don't get worried. Be that, take that as a lesson of just patient, you know, and that's fine. You know, he's my student, you know, like that. So you take care of them, even under the worst of times, okay? Then everything ends up happily ever after.